Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion.
Hello, Please enjoy. Thank you for joining the program. We ended last week discussing the development of compassion, especially for one's enemy, as an essential training on the road to enlightenment. This was in response to a line we find in the mind training like the rays of the sun, a textual commentary by Namka Pell of a well-known Buddhist mind training manual entitled Seven Points of Mind Training. Actually, the line comes from the Seven Points of Mind Training and is the very pithy instruction, meditate on the great kindness of others. In our pursuit of developing bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to gain enlightenment to be of greatest benefit to all beings, this instruction is included in a method known as exchanging self for others. In this method, we meditate on the disadvantages of self-cherishing and the advantages of cherishing others, to come to the conclusion to focus exclusively on the well-being of others and not being concerned with our own well-being, except in how it affects others' well-being. So we don't neglect ourselves, but rather we care for ourselves, because without optimum health and well-being, we are less able to help others. So it's not necessarily a renunciation of our lifestyle, so much as a change in motivation. Instead of doing everything for my own well-being, I will accomplish everything I can for others. But that means I must look after myself well. If I don't, how can I possibly help others effectively? So we look after ourselves in the pursuit of caring for others. Ironically, that means caring for our enemy, as we saw in last week's program. But now, before we continue from where we left off, let's consider our motivation as usual. And as usual, let's make bodhicitta that motivation, for it is the most beneficial of all motivations. May this program become the cause for me to become enlightened so I can benefit all beings in the best way possible, especially leading them to enlightenment. Something like that would be really good. Thank you. Now returning to mind training like the rays of the sun, we come to the conclusion of the section on the two ways of meditating to develop bodhicitta, the seven cause and effect, or six causes and one effect method, and the method of exchanging self for others. Namka Pell quotes Lungri Tampa when he writes, "The awakening mind, that is bodhicitta, is generated in dependence on sentient beings. But like the saying, whatever you do when wearing an iron helmet is unpleasant, to entertain such thoughts that wherever you are you feel vexed when encountering other beings who displease you, is like being unhappy with the causes of enlightenment." This means that being unhappy with those who annoy us is like being unhappy with what leads to enlightenment. Those who vex us are precisely the ones who allow us to practice patience, tolerance, and loving-kindness, qualities that are essential for liberation. Namka Pell also quotes the verse from Shantideva that goes on, "What is there to say more? The childish work for their own benefit, the Buddhas work for the benefit of others. Just look at the difference between them." And then goes on to say, "Thinking about this deeply, we should see that all faults arise from selfishness, whereas all good qualities come from benevolence towards others. This means that we should be concerned about sentient beings, should be fond of them, and think of them with affection. Therefore, we should keep up our efforts until our thoughts of concern for ourselves and neglect of others have changed places." He then moves on to a section entitled Actually Cultivating the Awakening Mind Concerned with the Interests of Others. Now, this is divided into two sections, meditation on love and meditation on compassion. Meditation on love is introduced with the epigram from the Seven Points of Mind Training that reads, "Practice a combination of giving and taking." Now, this refers to a practice known in Tibetan as Tonglen, in which one gives away all one's happiness and roots of happiness to others and takes on all their suffering. However, before arriving at that practice, our text goes through what giving away one's happiness means. And so Namka Pell introduces this subsection by saying, When we meditate on love by such means as giving away our bodies, possessions, and merit to others, we should firstly understand the benefits to be gained by doing so. Then we will be filled with a great eagerness to practice the actual techniques for activating love. He quotes the King of Meditative Stabilization Sutra in his attempt to illustrate the benefits. It reads, "Were we to make as many infinitely huge offerings as the millions and billions of realms in the universe, and were to offer them forever to the supreme beings, it would not compare with a fraction of the mind of love." And Namkaya Powell comments, "So the Buddha has said that the merit creating through love is far greater than that derived from constantly offering objects to Buddha fields across the far reaches of the universe." Now, I'm not sure how he translates the realms of the original quote to Buddha fields, but I haven't read the sutra or taken teachings on it. But I think you probably get the meaning that a moment of real love is more beneficial than making countless great offerings to the beings of all the realms. He then goes on to quote another sutra, the Sutra on the Adornment of Manjushri's Realm, which says, "In the northeastern direction, which is said to be adorned by 1,000 realms of the universe of the extremely powerful enlightened being Maheshvara, every sentient being experiences happiness like the bliss of those bhikshus who are absorbed in meditation on the cessation of suffering. Such good conduct extends over thousands of millions of years. Yet, were one person in our world to generate love for all sentient beings for even as long as it takes to snap his fingers, the merit he produced would be far greater. So what need is there to mention the value of abiding for day and night in meditation on love?" In the example, the sutra uses the example of the influence of the being Maheshvara. Now, the only being I know of with this name is the Hindu god of destruction or transformation, Shiva. So maybe that's who the sutra means. In any case, the beings in Maheshvara's realm experience enormous happiness for eons, like monks who are constantly meditating on freeing themselves from all suffering. But even the merit that produced such happy results pales when contrasted with the merit we gain if for the instant of a finger snap we were to have real love for all beings everywhere. That means not giving up on any being at all. Can we do that, even for a finger snap? Can we feel love instantly we see a cockroach crawling around in the kitchen? Or if a cobra suddenly reared its head right in front of us? Can we feel real love for Hitler or other tyrants like Syria's Bashar Hafez al-Assad or even Donald Trump? We probably can't even feel real love for the homegrown politician that heads the political party whose policies we oppose. So having real love might sound wonderful, but the love that wishes happiness and success and asks for nothing in return is not so easy. Imagine again your disliked politician. If this person changed their political stand, we might like to love them. But while he or she upholds political views opposite to our own, how easy will it be to wish for their well-being and happiness without demanding you must change your politics first? Actually, it's not easy to really know what the word love itself means, is it? It seems to mean different things to different people. Tibetan Buddhism takes a fairly simple approach to the definition of love. It is the wish for happiness, primarily the wish for happiness of others. However, this might seem a bit too simplistic. What does happiness mean? Everyone has their own idea of what will bring them happiness, and even for one person, it means different things at different times. For instance, would the things that make you happy when you were 6 years old still fill you with joy today? Would the objects of happiness of your teenage years still bring the same bliss today? Probably not. According to the Guardian newspaper, "What is love?" was the most searched phrase in Google in 2012, and you would probably find it still one of the most popular questions on the internet search engines. I guess there are more definitions on the net than you can count using a millipede's legs. But the Guardian takes a stab by asking a physicist, a psychotherapist, a philosopher, a romantic novelist, and a Benedictine nun to say what they think love is. The theoretical physicist and science writer Jim Al-Khalili, perhaps not unsurprisingly, says that love is chemistry. He writes, biologically, love is a powerful neurological condition like hunger or thirst, only more permanent. We talk about love being blind or unconditional in the sense that we have no control over it. But then, that is not so surprising since love is basically chemistry. While lust is a temporary, passionate sexual desire involving the increased release of chemicals such as testosterone and estrogen, in true love, or attachment and bonding, the brain can release a whole set of chemicals, pheromones, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, oxytocin, and vasopressin. However, from an evolutionary perspective, love can be viewed as a survival tool, a mechanism we have evolved to promote long-term relationships, mutual defense, and parental support of children, and to promote feelings of safety and security. I'll tell that to Romeo and Juliet. The psychotherapist is Philippa Perry, author of the book Couch Fiction. She writes, unlike us, the ancients did not lump all the various emotions that we label love under one word. They had several variations, including philia, which they saw as a deep but unusually non-sexual intimacy between close friends and family members, or as a deep bond forged by soldiers as they fought alongside each other in battle. Ludus describes a more playful affection found in fooling around or flirting. Pragma is the mature love that develops over a long period of time between long-term couples and involves actively practicing goodwill, commitment, compromise, and understanding. Agape is a more generalized love. It's not about exclusivity, but about love for all of humanity. Philautia is self-love, which isn't as selfish as it sounds. As Aristotle discovered, and as any psychotherapist will tell you, in order to care for others, you need to be able to care about yourself. Last, and probably least, even though it causes the most trouble, eros is about sexual passion and desire. Unless it morphs into philia and or pragma, eros will burn itself out. She thinks that love is all of those definitions, but doubts that we can experience all of them for any single person. This is why family and community are important, she concludes. Love is a passionate commitment. This is the statement of Julian Baggini, philosopher and writer. He says it is difficult to truly say what love is because it's not one thing. He writes, love for parents, partners, children, country, neighbor, God, and so on all have different qualities. Each has its variants: blind, one-sided, tragic, steadfast, fickle, reciprocated, misguided, unconditional. At its best, however, all love is a kind and compassionate commitment that we nurture and develop, even though it usually arrives in our lives unbidden. That's why it's more than just a powerful feeling. Without the commitment, it is mere infatuation. Without the passion, it is mere dedication. Without nurturing, even the best can wither and die. The writer Jojo Moyes, a two-time winner of the Romantic Novel of the Year Award, thinks love is the driver of all great stories. What love is depends on where you are in relation to it, she says. Secure in it, it can feel as mundane and necessary as air. You exist within it, almost unnoticing. Deprived of it, it can feel like an obsession, all-consuming, a physical pain. Love is the driver for all great stories, not just romantic love, but the love of parent for child, for family, for country. It is the point before consummation of it that fascinates. What separates you from love, the obstacles that stand in its way. It is usually at those points that love is everything. And now finally, the Benedictine nun, Catherine Wyburn, comes at it from a perspective of a binding force, although she admits that love itself is free. She says, love is more easily experienced than defined. As a theological virtue, by which we love God above all things and our neighbors as ourselves for his sake, it seems remote until we encounter it enfleshed, so to say, in the life of another, in acts of kindness, generosity, and self-sacrifice. Love is the one thing that can never hurt anyone, although it may cost dearly. The paradox of love is that it is supremely free, yet attaches us with bonds stronger than death. It cannot be bought or sold. There is nothing it cannot face. Love is life's greatest blessing. There is truth to all these thoughts naturally, and I'm sure we could spend a lot of time debating the various points that each definition raises. But in the interest of the economy of time and our lifespan, we'd better leave them for each of us to contemplate for ourselves. The attempt at defining love that I have up to now found most satisfying is from the bestseller The Road Less Traveled by Morgan Scott Peck. I have mentioned this definition before in these programs, so if you've heard it before, please be patient. In a chapter titled Love Defined, Peck writes, "I am very conscious of the fact that in attempting to examine love, we will be attempting to examine the unexaminable and to know the unknowable. Love is too large, too deep, ever to be truly understood or measured or limited in the framework of words. I would not write this if I did not believe the attempt to have value. But no matter how valuable, I begin with a certain knowledge that the attempt will be in some ways inadequate. One result of the mysterious nature of love is that no one has ever, to my knowledge, arrived at a truly satisfactory definition of love. In an effort to explain it, therefore, love has been divided into various categories: eros, philia, agape, perfect love, and imperfect love, and so on. I am presuming, however, to give a single definition of love, again with the awareness that it is likely to be in some way or ways inadequate. I define love thus: the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth. At the outset, I would like to comment briefly on this definition before proceeding to a more thorough elaboration. First, it may be noticed that it is a teleological definition. The behavior is defined in terms of the goal or purpose it seems to serve, in this case, spiritual growth. Scientists tend to hold teleological definitions suspect, and perhaps they will this one. I did not arrive at it, however, through a clearly teleological process of thinking. Instead, I arrived at it through observation of my clinical practice of psychiatry, which includes self-observation, in which the definition of love is a matter of considerable import. This is because patients are generally very confused as to the nature of love. He then goes on, "One of the major distinguishing features between acts of love and what seemed not to be love seemed to be the conscious or unconscious purpose in the mind of the lover or the non-lover. Second, it may be noticed that as defined, love is a strangely circular process, for the process of extending oneself is an evolutionary process. When one has successfully extended one's limits, one has then grown into a larger state of being. Thus, the act of loving is an act of self-evolution, even when the purpose of the act is someone else's growth. It is through reaching towards evolution that we evolve. Third, this unitary definition of love includes self-love with love for the other. Since I am human and you are human, to love humans means to love myself as well as you. To be dedicated to the human spiritual development is to be dedicated to the race of which we are part, and this therefore means dedication to our own development as well as theirs. Indeed, as has been pointed out, we are incapable of loving another unless we love ourselves, just as we are incapable of teaching our children self-discipline unless we ourselves are self-disciplined. It's actually impossible to forsake our own spiritual development in favor of someone else's. We cannot forsake self-discipline and at the same time be disciplined in the care for another. We cannot be a source of strength unless we nurture our own strength. As we proceed in our exploration of the nature of love, I believe it will become clear that not only do self-love and love of others go hand in hand, but that ultimately they are indistinguishable. Fourth, the act of extending one's limits implies effort. One extends one's limits only to be exceeding them, and exceeding limits requires effort. When we love someone, our love becomes demonstrable or real only through our exertion, through the fact that for that someone or for ourselves, we take an extra step or walk an extra mile. Love is not effortless. To the contrary, love is effortful. Finally, by the use of the word will, I have attempted to transcend the distinction between desire and action. Desire is not necessarily translated into action. Will is desire of sufficient intensity that it is translated into action. The difference between the two is equal to the difference between saying, I would like to go swimming tonight, and I will go swimming tonight. Everyone in our culture desires to some extent to be loving, yet many are in fact not loving. I therefore conclude that the desire to love is not itself love. Love is as love does. Love is an act of will, namely both an intention and an action. Will also implies choice. We do not have to love. We choose to love. No matter how much we may think we are loving, if we are in fact not loving, it is because we have chosen not to love, and therefore do not love despite our good intentions. On the other hand, whenever we do actually exert ourselves in the cause of spiritual growth, it is because we have chosen to do so. The choice to love has been made. Now, even though Peck does introduce his chapter by saying love is fundamentally unexaminable and unknowable, I wonder if many people won't find his description wrapping too many words around something that they feel is essentially intensely personal and inexpressible. But too many times we stick the label love onto something that resembles the real thing but is not. So often our love comes in the form of a contract. You make me happy, I make you happy. Of course, there may be elements of real love in such a contract, but there's also a great deal of ego and expectation, which probably means that in due course the elements of love will be swamped by disillusion and disgust when the contract appears to be broken. Following Beck's vision, this is more unlikely to happen, as the spiritual path explicitly turns its back on both ego and expectation. By encouraging more concern for our and others' spiritual progress, it widens the scope of what we think of as love until it includes all others. And that is where it approaches the sublime. I've also used a poem by Maya Angelou previously that expresses real love so wonderfully. The poem is titled Practicing Loving Kindness, and it goes like this. Bless the maniac barreling down the one-way street the wrong way, who shakes his fist when I honk. May he live long enough to take driving lessons. Bless the postman puffing under the no-smoking sign. When I complain, my mail goes mysteriously missing for months. Bless all those who debauch the air, the mother wafting fumes across her baby's carriage, the man whose glowing stub accosts a pregnant woman's face. May they unlearn how to exhale. Bless the politicians who both give and receive bribes and favors. Bless the constituents seeking personal gain, the thieves, the liars, the sharks. And bless the fools who make corruption easy. May they be spared both wealth and penury. Bless the soldiers guarding checkpoints where women labor and give birth in the dirt. Bless the settlers swinging clubs into teenagers' faces, the boys shooting boys with bullets aimed to kill, the men driving bulldozers that flatten lives to rubble. May they wake from the dream of power drenched in this cold sweat of understanding. May they learn the body's frailty, the immensity of soul. Bless the destroyers of Fallujah, the wreckers of Babylon, the torturers of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. May they understand desolation. May they comprehend despair. Bless the peacemakers, the teachers, the word workers, the wavers of flags, and the makers of fighter jets. May we know the ends of our labor and the means. May we make reparations. May we rebuild. Bless this planet, so cudgeled, so bounteous, the rainforests, the tundra, the ozone layer. May it preserve beyond our human follies. May it bloom. Bless cynicism, bless hope. Bless the fingers that type, the computer that processes, the printer that prints. Bless email and snail mail. Bless poetry books that cross oceans in battered envelopes bearing small flames of words. Can you see how in the tradition of transcendent beings of all the great forms of spirituality, Angelou's poem is not discriminatory, even against those she might find abhorrent. Bless the soldiers guarding checkpoints where women labor and give birth in the dirt. Bless the settlers swinging clubs into teenagers' faces, the boys shooting boys with bullets aimed to kill, the men driving bulldozers that flatten lives into rubble. May they wake from the dream of power, drenched in the cold sweat of understanding. May they learn the body's frailty, the immensity of soul. The definition of love in the Tibetan tradition is covered in the prayer associated with love in the Four Immeasurables. May you have happiness in its causes. How wonderful if you do have happiness in its causes. I dedicate myself to bringing you happiness in its causes. Such a commitment involves giving fully of oneself, and so love in the Tibetan tradition is very much an act of generosity, and necessarily selfless generosity. And so in his commentary on Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has this to say about the verse we are discussing. As for giving to others, there's giving our body, giving our wealth, giving the roots of our positive potentials so that they will ripen on others. The source of this is the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. As a practice of giving away our body, we first pray for inspiration. Then we think of the beings in various joyless realms, such as the reviving hells, or others in the hot hells and so forth. And we think of changing our body into cooling rain, for instance. Basically, we think of whatever those beings need to relieve their suffering. For the thirsty, we change into something to slake their thirst. For the hungry, something to satisfy their hunger. We change our body into whatever is needed by the beings in the joyless realms and take on the suffering of their disastrous situation. To stabilize this, we change our body into all the various positive qualities they will need to reach enlightenment, such as the seven Arya gems. And with that, we have to say goodbye, for we've now come to the end of our time together today. Thank you for joining the program, and if you've got some benefit out of it, please join us again next week. Also, dedicate any positive potential we've developed to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.
FM is a member of